Thanks for tuning in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. This is my new show time, 2 to 4 p.m. on Sundays now. So if you're listening to me, obviously you found my new show time, and I'll be on from 2 to 4 from now on Sundays, or at least until further notice. This is what I call the Peter Mac Show. I did a show for 5.5 years on a radio station in Liberty, Missouri called KCXL up until about mid-March, and then I was given this opportunity, and I hope I can continue to bring you valuable information that you're not going to hear elsewhere. There are a lot of good shows on this network, and I'm just very pleased to be a part of it. My special guest today is Larry Beecraft, Attorney Larry Beecraft. I'm honored to have him on. Larry and I met almost 2 years ago at the trial of Larkin Rose. He was in attendance there, not representing Larkin, but really just offering some counsel that he provided to Larkin in his trial. And so Larry agreed to come on today and discuss a host of issues. He has a website I'm going to give to you right now that's got just a plethora of information that's very helpful. And I know it's you'll have to jot this down, but if you miss it and you want it, you can always send me an email at peter@petermacshow.com. That's peter@petermacshow.com, and I can send you the link to this. I'll give it to you here. It's http://home.highway.net/tildeBeecraft. I'll do that once again. http://home. Highway is H-I-W-A-Y. .net/TildeBeecraft is spelled B-E-C-R-A-F-T. So, Larry, thanks for coming on my show today. This is, of course, a brand new time for me, and you have your show on from 9 to 10 on Saturdays, right?
That's correct. Hey, Peter, let me just make a correction to what you just said. The best way for people to get over my website is just simply go into Google, type in Beecraft Briefs, and there it is.
Very good. Thank you for that correction, Larry. Very good. And as I said, you have a lot of information on there. One article, which I hope we can address somewhat today, is your article on federal jurisdiction. And once somebody reaches your site, they can scroll down, about a third to halfway down, and they find a hyperlink to federal jurisdiction. And that, of course, is an important topic, Larry, because one of the issues which you're intimately connected with is the federal income tax. I know that you have an association of some sorts, friendship or otherwise, with Tom Cryer. And Tom Cryer was on my show a couple weeks ago, and he, of course, is set to go to trial for income tax evasion charges, I believe, now on July 9th.
That's correct.
Maybe you could just give folks an overview of your brief on federal jurisdiction, because I found it so interesting that contrary to what I've been brought up to believe, is that the federal government basically has jurisdiction over any matters within the 50 states, and yet your article has a number of case law that shows otherwise, right?
That's correct, Peter. Let me tell you how that got started. Back in the early 80s, you know, I became associated with the movement back in 1979. There was a man by the name of Tupper Saucy. He's now dead. He died a couple of months ago up in Nashville. But Tupper was a playwright and an illustrious figure, and he got involved with the money issue and wrote a book called Miracle on Main Street back in the about 1978 or 1979, and it became a booklet that or a book that everybody in the movement was just ecstatic about. And he happened to live just in the county north of me in Tennessee, so I went up there and started associating with him. And that's my basic introduction to the movement. Let's talk more after we come back
from
the break.
You hear the music and you know.
Yeah.
Okay, folks, we'll be back in just a couple minutes. Larry Beecraft, hang with us.
Self-defense needs. PersonAlarms.com carries the highest quality law enforcement grade pepper spray and sells it at true wholesale prices that start at $6.95. Check out our new electronic barking dog alarm. This electronic watchdog sees through walls. Electronic barking dog alarm works when an intruder comes within 15 feet. The barking dog alarm will begin barking like a true-to-life angry German Shepherd. The closer the intruder comes, the more frequent and more threatening the barking becomes. You can purchase stun guns, stun batons, pepper spray, telephone voice changers, martial arts instructional DVDs, and the same tasers that you have seen the police use on TV and more at www.personalarms.com/RBN. That's www.personalarms.com/RBN or call 1-201-641-1442. Don't be afraid anymore. Receive a free pepper spray by mentioning RBN when you place your online order. We will not sell items prohibited by any state, county, or local law, so check your laws before making a purchase.
Since 1988, Herbal Healer Academy has been the global supplier of the finest natural medicines. We specialize in keeping you alive and healthy. We provide outstanding products like ECX, colloidal silver, olive leaf extract, oregano oil, and hundreds of herbals, oils, books, and educational materials. We have homeopathic detox solutions for chemtrails, radiation, MSG, and aspartame poisoning. We also train naturopathic healers via correspondence education. Why wait any longer? Go ahead and do it today. Sign up on the web and receive our new 120-page catalog and a current Herbal Healer newsletter free. Simply log on to herbalhealer.com and check out the online member testimonials and our hundreds of exceptional products. That's herbalhealer.com, your website for safe, effective, natural alternatives and education. That's herbalhealer.com.
Hi, Steve Shank, Fearless Task Force. The J. Michael Stevens Group is shipping a lot of storable food. It's smart that you're getting going at your food supplies. 1 week after the report came out that the world had eaten more food than it produced last year, the country turned into a deep freeze, wiping out a huge part of the new crop. An example? In 24 hours, clementine oranges doubled in price. If you intend to start or finish your supply, call immediately. When you call, tell them how many adults and how many years of food you need. When there are shortages, missing items will be substituted, maintaining the quantity of food necessary. Money is not the problem. Availability is. Be careful. When food supplies get short, with no future, many retailers ship real trash to supply you. For safe food you can trust, call 800-409-5633. On the web, efoodsdirect.com. 800-409-5633.
Peter Mac Show. Thanks for tuning in here. My new show, of course, 2 to 4 p.m. You found us, unless you're listening to this as a recording. My special guest today is Larry Beecraft, and Larry was just telling us about his introduction to the movement in 1979, meeting a fellow named Tupper Saucy. So go ahead again, Larry, please.
Thank you. Right after that, Tupper started having meetings up in Suwanee, Tennessee, and across the country. And I attended them, and I became a fast friend of Tupper's. And one of the things that I noticed, in my introduction to the movement, Tupper was a proponent of Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the Constitution, no state shall make anything other than gold and silver coin, a tender and payment of debts. And we had a lot of meetings about that. But, you know, I would go to these meetings and try to teach people, you know, some basics about civil procedure and certain topics of law and constitutional law and things of that nature. But I began to detect that there was a real misunderstanding of it as to what jurisdiction was. So about 84 and 85, I started my own little educational project to teach people about jurisdiction. And I was working with a lady by the name of Billy Murdoch in Salt Lake City, Utah, and I started compiling a brief to explain Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the United States Constitution. You know, that particular section of the Constitution says Congress shall have the power of exclusive legislation over Washington, D.C., force magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. Well, based on that, you know, I just simply compiled a whole lot of cases that were on the point. But one time I was reading a Fifth Circuit case, and I ran across this reference to this 1957 government report. So I came back to my office and called Billy and said, hey, you know, why don't you go up to the library at Salt Lake and see if they've got that report. The next day she called me up and she said, well, not only was it there, you know, I now have a copy of it. So she mailed me it. And I looked it over, and it was just fantastic. It was a government report on the Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, what is jurisdiction of the United States. And, of course, over the next couple of years, Bill Benson and I, that was about the time that Bill was out promoting the argument about the non-ratification of the 16th Amendment. But one of the things Bill did is he took that government report, that copy that Billy had sent to him, and he reproduced it to look like the original. You know, the copy that we had was sufficient for reproduction, and Bill just made that report available, and so it's been all over the, you know, it's been sold into the movement for years and years and years, for 22 years now. I have scanned that report, and you can, for those that are interested in this issue, you can go over to a friend of mine's website, John Rowland. He operates a Constitution.org website.
Right.
And, you know, John's just got a wealth of material. You know, he goes, whenever he goes to a law library, he looks for old historical stuff, he scans it and puts it on his website. So it's just a ton of material, and you'll have to kind of look around on his website. There may be kind of a page that's devoted to jurisdiction. You can go over to that, but he has both an HTML, a copy of this report, as well as the scan of that report that I emailed to him and he posted here in the last 6 months. But
great.
The government report is, you know, really, really important. And what I'd like to inform people about during the course of this show is, you know, I see one of the big problems in the movement is, you know, people really don't have a background in law. You know, maybe that's part of the schooling. Maybe it's because people aren't interested in it. You know, there are a wide variety of reasons why people don't know much about law. Well, there's a lot of resources on the Internet through which people can learn.
Sure.
And what I would like to advise people to do is, if you go over to my website, and I think this issue is critically important. You know, we see, I encounter on a constant basis invalid, bad information that floats around as, you know, somebody's promoting something. I'll give you an example. There was a book several years ago that was kind of hot in the movement called Cracking the Code. And it's put out by a fellow, and it's different from the Cracking the Code call that was written by Pete Hendrickson.
Right.
But this one was, you know, premised on the UCC, and, you know, it ultimately built an argument that, you know, gee, we're the way to battle in court is to copyright your name, and, you know, then when you go to court, you know, judge, you know, you're using my name, and I'm charging you $5 million for every time you use your name. Well, you know, there's a fundamental flaw with that. You know, you can't copyright names.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that was used to really promote that book was this fellow came along and he quoted this Supreme Court case back in the 1790s, Penhallow versus Doane's Administrators. And, you know, the quote went something like this, that, you know, the government's an artificial entity and it can only communicate with artificial entities. Well, when you actually read that case, it's not in there at all. You know, the case is not on that point. It does not contain that quote. And that's something that I see repeatedly over and over and over again. It causes people that, you know, right now there's a whole bunch of people out there, particularly up in the Northwest, that are making and following this argument that we are all U.S. trusts. You know, that's just a fabrication.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is the type of information that floats around. And if you don't know anything about the law, you'll fall for anything.
Sure.
And that's something that I repeatedly see over and over and over again. You know, I've had people come into my, you know, here I am representing some people charged with tax crimes, and I have people like, you know, there's a fellow out in Colorado by the name of Jimmy Holden. He comes along, and he's twice advised my clients to file bankruptcy.
Hmm.
And, you know, bankruptcy will discharge criminal cases. No, it doesn't. But, you know, that type of advice, there's just a lot of people out there that are promoting this type of stuff. They're selling it. And, you know, it's just incomplete and bad information. And what I'd, you know, if people are interested in the topic of jurisdiction, it's something they can really learn about by visiting my website. I have several files. I've got a brief there that kind of explains the topic of jurisdiction. So if you just type in Beecraft Briefs, in Google and go over to my website and scroll down through. Let me stop and say that website that you see there, I started out just back in July of 1997. I said, well, I'm going to post information to that so that people can just learn. If I'm on the phone and I've got somebody inquiring about should they take the Fifth Amendment when they're talking to some government agents, you know, I can just simply, rather than telling them about what they should do, I direct them to a brief I've got posted on my website. That was its purpose initially.
Right.
And, you know, I've, over the years, I've just added more and more and more information. But one of the things that I've always considered important is this topic of federal jurisdiction. So if you go over to my website, I've got about four files that are posted there. You know, I have a brief that explains federal jurisdiction, and there are links. You know,
right.
You know, there's some real important jurisdiction cases. And I link the cases that are posted over on Fine Law. And what I would recommend that people do, you know, Peter, it's real simple. I've met people that have been in this movement for, you know, 20 years. And they seem to follow, you know, what the current hot argument. You know, you can make an argument hot in this movement. Of course, you can come into this movement and be, you know, just a loudmouth, and you can attract a lot of attention.
Sure.
But, you know, if you can come over to this movement, you can lose your job and come over to this movement and start selling bad legal advice, and you can make a fortune. You know, take a look at Lynn Meredith. But, you know, there are people that have been involved in this movement. All they do is they read what somebody else has to say. Well, I think it's high time for people to start having their own solid legal foundation. And it's not difficult. You know, most people can, they're students of at least the Internal Revenue Code. They're at least looking at statutes. Well, you know, cases are not that difficult to understand. So if, you know, if people would just sit down and just master one case a week, they would learn something.
Sure.
And so by the end of a year, they would have read 52 cases. Now, how difficult is that? And if you're interested in the federal jurisdiction topic, you know, take a couple hours on the weekend and read a couple of cases and, you know, understand it. And just keep coming back and take one topic and study it for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, and then you can soon master a topic. You know, it's a lot easier for people to sit down with what's available on the Internet and read something like a brief or read something like a government report and be astounded by it. You know, so the information is there. But to get back to the topic of federal jurisdiction, you know, when the Constitutional Convention happened, occurred back in 1787, they met in Philadelphia, you know, a big problem that had happened had been experienced by the Congress at that time was they had been meeting in Philadelphia, and as a result of the Revolutionary War, a bunch of the men that hadn't been paid for their services during the war, they came to Philadelphia, and they had kind of a ruckus there in Philadelphia and were threatening the congressmen. And Congress had to abandon Philadelphia, and they ultimately ended up in Annapolis, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that problem made it quite apparent that, you know, when they were creating the Constitution, they needed to create a capital.
Right.
And the Congress was going to have exclusive jurisdiction over the capital. It wasn't going to be in any specific state, you know, because you can see a problem that would crop up. You know, if you had a state that was opposed to Congress or a particular party in Congress, you know, that state could make it difficult for a you know, if you had a capital in a Democratic state and a lot of the congressmen were Republicans, you know, you could see how the state could influence the federal Congress. So that's one of the reasons why we created Washington, D.C. And Congress has exclusive jurisdiction there. The Constitutional Convention decided to give Congress the power of making war. So they said that, you know, Congress will have the power of exclusive legislation over force, magazine, darsels, and dockyards and other needful buildings.
Right.
Well, that was in there for a very specific reason, to give exclusive jurisdiction of Congress over areas that were needed for its own functions. And, of course, over the years, you had a lot of litigation on that point. And so the parameters of federal jurisdiction are quite well known. And there's a general principle of law that Congress, all federal legislation is inherently territorial or jurisdictional. And you have to look for through the statute to make a determination as to whether or not the statute itself has an express provision that says it's extraterritorial. And that's that principle of law needs to be understood by a lot of people. For example, this morning there's a lady lawyer I know over in a little town called Rainesville, Alabama. You know, picked up the paper this morning. We've had a criminal prosecution down in Montgomery, our state capital, of the former governor and a prominent supporter. We'll talk about that when we come back.
Okay. Stay with us, folks. I've got Larry Beecraft, attorney, on the line with us. We'll be right back talking about federal jurisdiction in just a couple minutes.
And you heard of a privacy crisis?
Odds are you're already immersed in one. The U.S. government is now legally tapping phones, monitoring emails, tracking purchases, and seizing property in record numbers. Banks are demanding invasive personal information for even the smallest transaction. Unfortunately, stalkers looking to harm you or your financial situation are using the same methods. So how can you protect yourself, your loved ones, and all that you own? Well, the first step is to purchase the most important how-to book you'll ever read. It's called Privacy Crisis by author Grant Hall. In minutes, you'll know the methods he himself has used and advised others about in order to bank anonymously, open a safety deposit box without a social security number. With Privacy Crisis, you'll discover how to avoid judgments, seal your credit files airtight, drop off the radar, and virtually disappear from those looking to cause you injury. The ebook and hardcover versions are available at www.privacycrisis.com. Grant Hall's Privacy Crisis contains information and legal methods the powers that be don't want you to know. Travel, bank, work, and live anonymously, live free. You can also order Privacy Crisis by telephone. Call 702-433-6222.
All right, employees, listen up. Our group health insurance premium just went up again. In fact, it's doubled in the last 4 years, and now we've been forced to try something new. So we're increasing the annual deductible from $500 to $2,500. Okay, cut the moaning. The good news is you'll all still only have to pay your regular $500 deductible. The company is installing a new health reimbursement arrangement, or HRA plan, that will pay up to $2,000 in benefits only to those employees who have deductible expenses. This new HRA plan is saving us a lot of money.
Employers all over the country are discovering how to roll back insurance costs using Core Documents' HRA concept. Core Documents is the nation's primary source for affordable plan documents required by the IRS and Department of Labor for Section 125 and HRA plans. Use your insurance agent and let Core Documents help you with plan design. Do a Google search for Core Documents or see us at coredocuments.com. That's Core, C-O-R-E, documents, plural, .com.
I found this company online, and they had this really unique variety of salt wellness products. I read some of the articles and ended up ordering this beautiful salt lamp. According to the company, they said that the salt crystal lamps gently purify indoor air. I was so amazed. I put it in the baby's room, and it made a perfect nightlight. Both my husband and I could tell the difference.
SoleWellness.com is a unique company that offers salt wellness products from around the world.
So, I went back to the site and ordered their Soleil Simple Natural Cleaning Products, also made with Himalayan salt. I figured it would clean really well. The natural cleaning products worked wonderfully, and there was no scent. This company has so many products my whole family can enjoy and feel better with. Plus, the service was great.
If you're interested in natural, homeopathic, time-tested remedies, visit SoleilWellness.com. That's S-O-L-A-Y Wellness.com. Or call 312-224-2710. 312-224-2710.
We're back. Thanks for tuning in to the Peter Mac Show. We're discussing federal jurisdiction with Larry Beecraft. Go ahead, Larry.
Paper this morning and started reading. We've got this criminal case involving a former governor and one of his wealthy supporters. They're going to be sentenced for a conspiracy and mail fraud and stuff like that in this criminal case that was tried last year down in Montgomery, Alabama. Before I continue with the story of Jill, let me just tell you about this particular judge in this case. And for those that are interested, if you want to know something about the financial net worth of a federal judge, you can go over to Judicial Watch's website, and there's a link there that you can go to. They have gone out, and by means of FOIA, or, you know, you probably don't need to make a FOIA request for it, but let's presume that they did do it by FOIA. You can get all of the financial disclosure statements of all the federal judges, and that's exactly what Judicial Watch has done. And this particular judge that tried this case of Don Siegelman, our former Alabama governor, and one of his supporters, Scrooge, they have recently found out that the judge that tried that case is on the, federal trough, so to speak. Not just as a federal judge.
Right.
He is the owner, along with several others, of a corporation that does contract work for the government. They sell also all sorts of things to the government. And, this one of these defendants in this case is Richard Scrooge fella. He's owns you know, a hospital consortium here in Alabama. You know, he's quite wealthy. You know, he's only spent about $30 million on his case thus far. But, you know, this judge that he's in front of, you know, makes millions per year selling various items to the federal government.
Judges are not precluded from engaging in that kind of business?
Well, yeah, I mean, you got to look, you know, this particular case is, you know, the governor asked Richard Scrushy to get on a state board. And at about the same time, Richard Scrushy had donated, there was a project that the government was interested in, gambling. Not that I'm interested in gambling, but that was the proposal at the time. And so Scrushy chipped in $500,000, and it happened to be at the time that he was being appointed to this state board. And, of course, this is the genesis, this is the core fact situations of this criminal case against them. And, you know, so here you got a wealthy Alabama citizen and an Alabama governor being accused of, you know, corruption. And they're trying this case in front of this federal judge that, you know, I mean, you know, for what it's worth, you know, it looks, in my view, kind of bad. Why is a federal judge, you know, what influence does he have does not his personal interest, does not his receipt of millions of dollars per year from the federal government make him less than partial in a case? Isn't that a very interesting question?
Sure. Well, can't they ask him to recuse himself? In that
situation? You know, nobody knew about this until, you know, this lady lawyer, I think, over in Rainsville that I know of. This is something that's come up here kind of recently. The defense in this case has uncovered. And, of course, this lady lawyer that I was telling you about moments ago over in Rainsville, Alabama, she's making the news in her local Sunday paper about how she submitted an affidavit in this case and said that she was a participant in a phone call with several, you know, important Alabama politicians several years ago. And these politicians made a comment that they were going to go out and get the former governor and get Richard Scrushy.
Wow.
And, you know, that's what's been happening. So here you have, you know, here it is several, you know, 217 years later, after the Constitution's in effect, we got Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 in place in the Constitution. And here, you know, what is different from what happened back in when Congress was being attacked by these partisans, the soldiers of the Revolutionary War, and caused Congress to flee from Philadelphia? There you had state pressure put on the feds. Mm-hmm. But how is that different from what's happening in this case down in Montgomery, Alabama? You know, here you've got the feds coming along and they're exerting pressure on the political structure of Alabama.
Right.
Well, you know, what's the constitutional authority for all that? This case is premised upon interstate commerce, but you know, unless people have an understanding of jurisdiction, you know, you go out here and talk to the people that know nothing about law. And they just simply sit there and read the papers. You know, they can't even formulate an opinion in their own head because of their lack of knowledge as to whether or not, you know, the whole case itself is fishy.
Right.
And that's my point.
Well, let me ask you this, Larry. If I understood you a few minutes ago, you said, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the jurisdiction of the federal government is basically confined to Washington, D.C. and those other specific territorial areas over which they have exclusive jurisdiction, unless a statute gives them some kind of jurisdiction within the 50 states. Is that a correct summary?
Yeah, that's the constitutional presumption that rises out of. That's the, you know, pregnant clause, so to speak, of, you know, that's the import of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. So, you know, the cases say that inherently the jurisdiction that the federal legislation applies within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States unless the contrary intent clearly appears.
Okay.
So you got some real problems here. Let's kind of digress a minute. Before I move on to that, let me make one point to kind of cover some grounds we talked about a minute ago about erroneous information and how important it is to know something about law. This last week, you know, there was a circulating over the internet, you know, this little short piece. You know, there was a piece on the WorldNet Daily talking about this recent presidential directive that came out in early May of this year.
Right.
And, you know, talked about, you know, what would happen in the event of some terrorist plot that erupted inside this country. Well, you know, people said, wow, man, look what this presidential directive says. You know, of course it is. It's, you know, you sit down and you read it, and it's enough to curl your hair.
Right.
But, you know, people come along and, you know, there's a furor raised over executive orders. You know, the proper response to that is you know, I sent out an email and said, look, you know, there's a part of the picture that people are missing here regarding executive orders. And, of course, people for years have been talking about executive orders. Well, you know, there's to properly understand this, you need to go back to Truman's seizure of the steel mills back in 1952, and let's talk about that when we come back.
Okay, very good, very good. Hold on, folks. I'm talking with Larry Beecraft in general about federal jurisdiction. We'll be back in just a couple minutes. Stay with us.
Where perverts and the godless write the rules. Our unborn children are murdered, our esteemed elders are euthanized, and everyone in between is numbered and tracked like criminals so they can be farmed by government, credit, healthcare organizations, like the chicken farmer farms his chickens. Have you had enough? Is it time to declare your liberty? It's your choice, you know. The only place to begin to declare your independence is to have enough food stored so that you never have to go stand in a bread line to give away the rest of your life or sell your children for a bowl of rice and a slice of bread. Call 800-409-5633. On the web, efoodsdirect.com. 800-409-5633.
In the United States, it is now estimated that over 90% of family income is now being used to pay back consumer debt. Because of financial problems, mostly from credit card debt, approximately one in four families struggle to pay bills on even basic necessities such as mortgage, food, and utilities. And with millions of people desperately searching for a fresh start, North American Educational Services is here to help you regain your financial independence. We are very proud that the Debt Relief Educational Services Program has helped over 8,100 families nationwide since 1998, eliminating over $215 million of credit card debt, and still counting, and enabled clients to stop monthly payments immediately. The NAES program is unique, designed to help you, the consumer, not your creditors. To take back your financial freedom, call 1-888-245-7097. That's 1-888-245-7097. Or visit www.integritydebtoptions.com.
Hi, Steve Shank, Fearless Task Force. Sure, you've got a mortgage and credit cards. Your debt creation is probably the smartest thing you've ever done. How would it be to find $75,000, $150,000, $200,000 or more you never knew you had? Now the task force has strategies to make these debts into virtual savings accounts. Ben Franklin said, a penny saved is a penny earned. By doing nothing more than you're doing right now, because you've used your credit,
in the United
the right
States,
strategy can make the debt part of your financial life the smartest thing you've ever done. Oh, by the way, your strategies cost you nothing out of pocket. Go ahead and check out the debt elimination scams if you'd like to. You wouldn't take money from a loan shark, so you may not want to give your money to a debt shark. For an understanding of what a financial genius you truly are, call 800-409-5633. On the web, mydebtfreepath.com. 800-409-5633.
Thanks for tuning in here to the Republic Broadcasting Network. We're talking about federal jurisdiction with attorney Larry Beecraft. Larry, you were just about to talk about...
we're going to talk about the young... Yeah. This is real important because, you know, a population that doesn't know anything about the law, whether it's coming from members of your own group or whether it's coming from the government itself, if you don't know anything, you're subject to anything... And you'll believe anything. And, you know, we've got all this news all the time, you know, like, you know, Hillary coming along. Well, we need national health care and stuff like that. If people don't understand something about the legal basis for the topic, you know, they'll swallow anything.
Sure.
Now, let me get the point I was making about the steel seizure cases. You know, here at FDR died and Truman came in, and, you know, in 1952 he's engaged in the Korean War. And he sees a looming steel strike coming up. Mm-hmm. So his solution is, oh, gee, you know, I can't, you know, let the Army and the Navy and, you know, the Air Force be hurt by, you know, the steel strike. Mm-hmm. So he sends in some men to take over the steel mills.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the steel mills could have sat there and, you know, done nothing, you know, let the president take over the steel mills.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, they went to court, and there's this case that went to the Supreme Court back in the early 50s. It's called Youngstown Sheet and Tube against Sawyer. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the Supreme Court said, you know, the president doesn't have any inherent authority to take over businesses in this country.
Right.
You know, the only way that could be possible for the president to do that would be as if he had some statutory legislation. But, you know, even that would be suspect, you know, open to challenge too. But, you know, in the steel seizure cases, you know, where Truman tried to take over the steel mills, the Supreme Court said, no way, Jose.
Right.
And, you know, that's the, you know, people need to know, you know, when they're considering some argument built upon executive orders, they, you know, if they could sit down and spend 30 minutes just reading over Youngstown Sheet and Tube, you know, they would learn something. And then people wouldn't be buffeted about, you know, because they really don't know anything about law. But I digress. Let's go back to federal jurisdiction. Peter, you know, you were talking about this principle of law, you know, what's jurisdictional and what's not. What
right.
is inherently within the jurisdiction of the United States. And let me tell you, you know, I think that these are matters that could take on a new life. And here's the reason. Computers are a whole lot different from what we were dealing with 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We've now got the, you know, to me, if you're going to do something scientific, you know, like study, you know, the human body or study trees, you know, like magnolia trees that I'm looking at right now in full bloom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're going to sit down and study something, you have to have a, you know, something to study. Well, you know, the freedom movement has a whole lot to study, and it can be compiled.
Mm-hmm.
And just imagine, think in your mind, Peter, I don't know, have you ever been to a law library and take a look at the United States?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Sure.
You know, the statutes at large contain all the federal laws. You know, before 1845, there were various books about, you know, that contain the acts of Congress, but in 1845 they decided to kind of reprint everything and put it into a set of books called the United States Statutes at Large. And Statutes at Large is the original source of federal law. And in the states, you got the acts of the state legislature. You know, they're the original acts.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have today is something we didn't have at the beginning of this country. We didn't have in 1980. We didn't have in 1990. We didn't have in 1995.
Right.
You know, since the late 90s have we had all of this stuff that's been going online. Well,
right.
I have, you know, I sat down and I spent 6 months. A client, you know, put me in a position to, you know, every day I would come into my office and I took PDF scans of the entire United States statutes at large. I pulled them up and assembled them in 50-page blocks and ran OmniPage behind it and saved the PDF image on top of the text conversion.
Mm-hmm.
And I now have created, you know, if you looked at, in a library, the statutes at large, you would see a bookcase, you know, typically about two or three rows, you know, the typical library, university library bookshelf. You know, you got something that's about 7 or 8 feet tall and, you know, maybe 10 or 15 rows of books on it, and maybe it's about 3.5 or 4 feet, you know, wide. Imagine something like that three times. That's the United States statutes at large.
Okay.
And going back to 1789. Well, now all of that is converted into searchable text.
Right.
And, you know, you can even, you know, what I do on a periodic basis, you know, for the last several years, I just simply go over to, you know, the website where the current statutes of large are posted. They're posted there in PDF images. And so I pull off one by one the various legislative acts. There's not any, you know, a lot of people think that Congress is real busy all the time because they're in Washington, D.C.
Right.
You know, Congress doesn't pass but about 200-250 bills a year. And guess what? Most of them are changing post office names to something new.
Huh.
You know, so there isn't a whole lot of major legislation in any given year, but, you know, they imagine to, they do have the ability to produce, you know, 3,000 and 4,000 pages worth of, you know, stuff that goes into the statutes large, but all of that's word searchable. And for our listeners, if you want to pull up about 10 volumes and download them of the statutes large, go to John Rowland's website. You know, I've sent him some discs. He's still putting stuff up on his website, but, you know, I've sent him some discs, and, you know, for about volume 110 through volume 120, it's posted over the website.
Yeah, let me just remind folks that that's constitution.org.
Yeah. You can pull down, if you go over to constitution.org and search around, you know, he's got, I can get lost on his website, so it could be a task locating this, but, you know, he has huge pages with a lot of material on it.
Right.
And you can download statutes at large. Now, one of the things that's real important, you know, now that I personally have the ability to search through the statutes at large using word searches, you know, I do that frequently. You know, my TV time, I don't watch TV at all. The only time I watch TV is, you know, I struggle home after second shift here at the office. I might make it home by 10 o'clock, and then I turn on my laptop. You know, some nights 9 o'clock. But, you know, for about 30 minutes, you know, like I did last night, Saturday night, you know, I've got a current little project. You know, I'm compiling all these pages from the statutes at large to deal with federal and national. Real important.
Right.
Real important. And, you know, since we have the capability now of completely searching, and you can go over to, there's a lot of state codes that are posted on, you know, every state code, to my knowledge, you know, I don't go looking around. I use an electronic, you know, legal service, Lois Law, you know, so I have access to it. But, you know, I have looked around enough to know that, you know, if you go over to Find Law, you can pull down and have access to all the electronic versions of all the state codes.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have a tremendous amount of information that's posted on the Internet. And that information can be very, very helpful. You know, from where I'm going, right now I'm building arguments, legal arguments, that are based on, you know, before the show began, you said, gee, let's talk about individual. Well, you know, there's a, you know, unless you've done a study on the word individual through the statutes large, you know, there, you can easily get lost.
Right.
You know, I know that there's some 14th Amendment people that are, you know, I've done some battling on the Internet. You know, they like to call themselves nationals. Well, you know, I simply do not like to call myself national. I never would, but there are people out there that are advocating it. But, you know, the word national, let me tell you how that, you know, this is what the statutes at large reveals, that, you know, the word national means inherently a citizen from the insular possessions. And this starts off, remember when we started acquiring, you know, the Philippines and places like that back in 1898, 1900, Virgin Islands, you know, when we started acquiring these insular possessions, you know, Congress had to come up with a way to identify or describe the people that are there.
Right.
And, you know, from my research through these statutes at large, I found that when Congress started doing this, they started describing the people in the insular possessions as persons who owe a duty of allegiance to the United States.
Mm.
And, you know, that phrase starts popping up in the statutes at large around, you know, 1900, 1902. And that's when you begin to see it kind of pop up. Well, then later it kind of vanishes, and it gets replaced with this word known as, you know, this word national. And if you sit down and take a look at the statutes at large, national is a direct reference to a citizen, the insular possessions.
And so that's not those of us that are born in one of the 50 states.
No, I'm a citizen. However, that does not mean, though, that Congress can't, in a specific act, you know, come along and definitions are real important. The word person's real important. And, you know, you'll find that periodically Congress will come along, and rather than, you know, you're just using the phrase citizens or national, you know, if you pull down some of the recent statutes at large posted over on John Rowland's website, and once you got them downloaded, start doing word searches, you know, and then put in citizen and do a word search on it. Mm-hmm. And you'll come up with, even today, Congress is using the phrase, you know, citizen, resident, national, or person. Mm-hmm. You know, though that's kind of a typical phrase that Congress uses. But, you know, at times Congress will come along and define a citizen within, you know, if a special definition of a word appears in a legislative act, you know, sometimes Congress will throw in the word citizen as included in that. And that's what they've done with the naturalization laws over in Title 8. You'll find the citizen is included in some of those terms that's over there. But, you know, inherently, national is... You know, it starts off as, and it's still described today. You know, you can, you know, if you do searches on the internet try to find definitions of national in some of these state codes or some of these state administrative codes, you'll plainly see that, you know, national is identified as somebody that's in the insular possessions. You know, so a national is one that lives in Guam, Puerto Rico, American Samoa, the Virgin Islands, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've digressed, Peter. You know, I've gone a long ways off the topic of jurisdiction, and let's get back to that.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this then. As I understand it, based upon this Youngstown Sheet versus Tube and Tube Company versus Sawyer, that executive orders have no legislative authority. I mean, presidents do these all the time, and they're not challenged. But if they were to be challenged, presumably they would – adjudicated the same way this Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company was.
We've got existing precedents. You know, so if you don't know about existing precedents, you know, there, you know, people that don't know anything about Youngstown Sheet and Tube, you know, that'll come along and see, read some article, typically in the Freedom Movement, about, oh, look at this horrible executive order. God, the president's contemplating doing this. Well, you know, I'd rather have, you know, some authority that backs up my position. And, you know, of course, I wouldn't want the President of the United States doing anything like that. And, you know, going out and locating existing authority in your favor is always important. Youngstown Sheet and Tube says, hey, the President's got to have statutory authority to do all these things. Right now, the President doesn't have any authority, executive authority. There's no statutes that sit around.
Yeah, but my point, Larry, is that unless somebody challenges the President in court, the executive order is going to hold sway on people, right?
Well, but you know what? Hadn't you rather know something about the point? President can't do it. What kind of legal argument are you going to come up with? You know,
well,
I
agree, but I'm just saying that unless it's challenged, unless people know about cases like Youngstown, the president's going to go ahead and act. And
absolutely, yes, I agree 100%. That's the reason why we started off this show today. We're talking about how important it is for people to increase their knowledge of the law.
Right.
And, you know, I've seen for many, many years too many people talking about, you know, executive orders, and, well, you know, that's fine and nice. You know, maybe the president's got some type of contingency plans. Maybe there's going to be some conspiracy to battle and destroy the United States Constitution. But, you know, hey, you know, one tool that I'd use against the President of the United States, if he tried to do that, is I'd scream and holler. You know what? The population understands this. You know, we've got new tools. But if they don't understand it, they could fall for it.
Right.
And
well, they do
point.
Fall for it. Sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. And now, let's drift back to jurisdiction.
Right.
You know, and this is a topic I've also got covered over on my website, and it's in a little file under the topic of jurisdiction, but it's called treaties. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe we can talk about treaties later on in the show, but, you know, pursuant to the treaty powers of Congress, Congress doesn't have any limits on the subject matters that could be the various subject matters that could be encompassed within a treaty. And, you know, I maintain that quite often Congress goes out and adopts a treaty with another nation, and boom, then the next thing you know, we got federal laws on that point. You know, a prime example is back in about 86 or 87, you know, we got a new statute in Title 18, genocide. And, well, genocide's treaty-based. And you know, there's a whole lot of federal laws that are treaty based. But let's get back to Social Security and jurisdictional implications. And you know, I mentioned the treaty memo on my website because this aspect of Social Security is covered in the treaty memo. I didn't stick it over my brief on jurisdiction, but I'm just simply saying it's over there in a different topic, treaties. But the first time, there was a lot of interest in social legislation from the European countries after World War One.
Mm-hmm.
And, the communism was spreading, and, there was a lot of interest in social legislation. So, in the 30s, there was social legislation dealing with, not social legislation, treaties. They were being promoted by the, League of Nations, mm-hmm. Dealing with Social Security. Well, the first time that Congress comes along and attempts to do something with Social Security, the first act that came out in 1934 was one that would provide Social Security to railroad workers. Let's talk when we come back.
Okay, stay with us, folks. We're talking to attorney Larry Beecraft, generally about federal jurisdiction. We'll be back in just a couple minutes.
Catholic priest calls on Catholics and Christians to resist an unjust attack against Iran. Father John Martinez, a Catholic priest, speaks out to declare the Catholic Church's true teaching, that it would be a mortal sin for Catholic soldiers to attack Iran. In a one-hour lecture, Father John Martinez warns about the Jewish plot to rule the world and to use the United States to ignite the flames of World War III by its satanic plan to unjustly attack Iran. He exposes that George Bush is Jewish and how Congress is controlled by the Jews. Father John Martinez gravely warns of nuclear weapons being used by the United States and the threat of the possible end of the world. For additional information on how you can help stop World War III, order Father John Martinez's CD entitled An Unjust Attack on Iran, available for $10 by Father John Martinez. Just go to www.republicbroadcasting.org and click on our web banner for the address.
Businesses and their employees are facing constant increases in group medical insurance premiums. Employees are shouldering more of the burden themselves. Core Documents, the nation's primary source for affordable medical plan documents, has the answer. A health reimbursement arrangement, or HRA. Business owners, managers, find out now how your company can utilize a much higher deductible health insurance policy and establish an HRA to fund low deductibles for your employees. And employees, tell the boss to visit coredocuments.com now. This new HRA plan can save you thousands of dollars.
Employers all over the country are discovering how to roll back insurance costs using Core Documents' HRA concept. Core Documents is the nation's primary source for affordable plan documents required by the IRS and Department of Labor for Section 125 and HRA plans. Use your insurance agent and let Core Documents help you with plan design. Do a Google search for Core Documents or see us at coredocuments.com. That's Core, C-O-R-E, documents, plural, .com.
I found this company online, and they had this really unique variety of salt wellness products. I read some of the articles and ended up ordering this beautiful salt lamp. According to the company, they said that the salt crystal lamps gently purify indoor air. I was so amazed. I put it in the baby's room, and it made a perfect nightlight. Both my husband and I could tell the difference.
SoleWellness.com is a unique company that offers salt wellness products from around the world.
So, I went back to the site and ordered their Soleil Simple Natural Cleaning Products, also made with Himalayan salt. I figured it would clean really well. The natural cleaning products worked wonderfully, and there was no scent. This company has so many products my whole family can enjoy and feel better with. Plus, the service was great.
If you're interested in natural, homeopathic, time-tested remedies, visit SoleilWellness.com. That's S-O-L-A-Y Wellness.com. Or call 312-224-2710. 312-224-2710.
Welcome back, folks. You're back with the Peter Mac Show and my special guest, Larry Beecraft, and we're talking about jurisdiction, and you were just about to talk about
the first Social Security Act.
You're right. 1934?
Yeah, 1934. And here you have we'll cover here maybe in a moment the federal gun laws and talk about that, but let's limit our content. There's a similar parallel with the federal gun laws. Okay. Let's go back to Social Security. We had, 1934, the Supreme Court of the United States was being handed to it some cases. There was a number of cases when Congress came along and imposed this tax on railroads and other interstate transportation, you know, means.
Uh-huh.
People involved in interstate commerce were being taxed, and they had the benefits of a Social Security scheme. Well, that issue was variously decided by some of these federal appellate courts, and ultimately that issue ends up at the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court in May 1935 came out in a case and said, you know, Congress does not have the, you know, let's look at this. Social Security is to provide benefits to the worker. But the Supreme Court ultimately held, said, look, Congress doesn't have the power to provide, you know, all these benefits to the worker. And so the broadest power of Congress, one of its broadest powers, is the power to regulate and control interstate commerce.
Right.
And so here you had a Social Security scheme that was directly connected to interstate commerce, and the Supreme Court of the United States in May 1935 came along and shot that down. What was the
case, Larry? Do you recall?
Oh, God. It's over on my website, Alton Railway, the Alton Railway case of 1935. Go into my treaty memo,
okay.
And, you know, it's down there. I'm just kind of summarizing, maybe,
sure.
You know, elucidating it a little bit more.
That's fine.
What's in that
That's
treaty
fine.
Memo. But the Alton Railway okay. case is where the Supreme Court shot it down. Now, Peter, let me ask you a simple question. What amendments to the Constitution were there between May of 1935 and September 1935 to provide for Social Security? Where is that amendment? Is that Amendment 42?
Amendment to the U.S. Constitution?
Yeah.
I don't know of any.
You don't know of any?
No, I know of an amendment that should preclude that, namely the 10th Amendment.
Yeah, that's true. But there was no amendment.
Right.
So now you have, in August of 1935, Congress comes out with the second Social Security Act. Now, you can read, you know, there's been a lot of hoopla about the second Social Security Act. There's been a group of people, the redemptionists, running around and saying, oh, gee, you know, Congress created an account for every American by means of the second Social Security Act, and you got a 600,000 or a million, depending on who's telling the story. You know, you got money in the Social Security account, you know, and your birth certificate was sold to, you know, the government pursuant to that. You know, of course, none of that is in the second Social Security Act. None of that. People that'll tell you that, they're lying. But I digress. Let's go back to the second Social Security Act. When you see, let me stop and say, I have also sent to John Rowland, and it may be over on my website too. I don't know. If I do, I have a link. But you know, you can see the actual 1935 Social Security Act on the internet, and I would suggest going over to Constitution.org and looking for that act over there. Mm-hmm. When you sit down and you read it, Peter, I want you to ask this simple question. Where, pray tell, can one find any statement that this act, being mindful that a mere 3 months before this act was passed, the Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional? Tell me where there is anything in that act. And the one that you pull up on John Rowland's website, let me just tell you, you can do word searches in that act, so have at it. Where is there a provision in that act that says that it applies within the jurisdiction of the states?
Well, wait a minute, Larry. You said that the Supreme Court ruled that unconstitutional 3 months before Congress passed it?
Yes. Well, but then Congress came. The first act